The healthy and the vital artist versus the depressed and the degenerate artist, according to Friedrich Nietzsche. Now, the common trope that we associate with an artist is a guy who is tortured. He is a tortured genius. We have this idea inside of our minds that certain characters pop up out of the population, out of the herd. They go to school like all of the rest of us. They go and have to sit there and go through the ordeal of getting educated by these half-wits. Just like all the rest of us, they go out into the world and they see the suffering and the pain and the struggle. But we are able to rationalize, we are able to escape from this, we are able to put blinders to what reality is actually like. But these artists are not like this. They're too sensitive, they just can't hack it. And all the pain and suffering of life buckles them and breaks them. And they have to go in this path of self-destruction. Some type of horrible energy is inside their souls and they have to attack themselves and try to destroy themselves. And in this great act of self-destruction and this great hate against life and against the world, this great tragedy and struggle which is their life, out of this chaos, this nastiness, out of this horror comes this explosion of creative potential. It's almost like they destroy themselves like Shiva and then cut through the reality of the universe and see the world as it actually is and pull back from us great art and great music that explains to us the nature of reality. And we call this the tortured genius, the person who has a dark cloud hanging over their heads, but they get to see forms that we cannot possibly comprehend because they're willing to go into the darkness in a way that we aren't. They are some type of heavy metal shamans. Look at the infamous Kurt Cobain. Depressed, jaded, his music all carries this air of heaviness. He clearly has some type of darkness inside of him and he's releasing, expressing that darkness in his songs, and we look at something magical about him as a consequence. We always look at characters like this as being in touch with some sort of magic. But what if the truth is that they are not magical? They do not have access to some special truth that we don't have. What if they are actually sick? What if they are struggling with life and not revealing to us some divine reality, some higher truth, some higher artistic magnificence that we can't possibly comprehend, us silly plebs? What if, in fact, they are sick and weary of life? They are weak. They are not spiritually capable of overcoming life. And they create music that acts as an infection that spreads this depression and this weariness onto us. What if the case is that Kurt Cobain is not a genius, but he's just a fucking bitch? In Twilight of the Idols, Nietzsche sets forth a different notion of what the artist could be. Instead of this tortured genius, what would the opposite conception look like? And it's one of my favorite passages. It's called Concerning the Psychology of the Artist. And what Nietzsche does is he meditates on the place from which the creative energy comes from. And this, of course, is the soul, the inner world. All these forces inside of Kurt Cobain that releases, that is the well from which he draws inspiration to produce his art. That's actually what he's channeling through his music, is the inner pain that he has. This is his soul, his inside world. And of course, Nietzsche loved that part of people because he was the first psychologist, the psychologist of the highest rank, the first rank among the world. And so Nietzsche asks an interesting question. I guess Nietzsche didn't really ask this question. This is more me. But he says, if Kurt Cobain was sick and limp-willed and tired of life and generally a little bit more of a depressed dork than we think, what would the opposite of this be? What would it look like if we had somebody who's full of power? What happens if inside of their souls was not all these depressed feelings of the weariness and struggle of life, of him not being good enough, of him having addictions, of his life being full of pain? Kurt Cobain had a stomach issue his whole life, that it was always filling his life full of pain. And so what we're receiving in frequency through the music, think about this, let's get mystical. Let's hang out with the yoga girls and say, I don't want to listen to that because it's got bad vibes. Kurt Cobain's soul was full of bad vibes, and that's what he was putting out in his songs. What would the opposite be? What if we had a soul, a person who was full of life energy, who was full of exploding joy, who was full of health and power, who felt powerful? What is the healing opposite to feeling weak and feeling burdened by life? That feeling of the sizzle in your fingers, oh, I can take on anything. I can do anything. I'm indomitable. I can conquer the world. I feel powerful. I feel like electricity, lightning shunting through my hands. What would that person feel like? What would their soul, what type of art would their soul release? There's an interesting question. Do you hear Western music with that type of energy in it anymore? I want you to pause for a second and think about this. There's a great insight into the malaise of our time. When you learn to see things from this perspective, you develop the capacity to judge art in this way, to judge culture in this way. What type of vibe is it putting out? You need to go to yoga class and hang out with the girls and notice the way they see things, the way they try to feel the energy off stuff. What do you notice coming out of Western music? You will consistently notice these Kurt Cobain thematics, the pain and struggle of life. Maybe the pain and struggle of love is the most common one. This energy of being, oh, I've lost a girl or something like this. I'm so depressed. I feel so bad. Or life is so hard and I'm a depressed, tortured poet. You know, this is the sort of ideas we have in our heads that in order for you to be a pop musician or something like this, you have to create these very depressed lyrics about the struggle of life. Or maybe you would go and you would say to yourself, right, I'll be a postmodern novelist or writer. And you take a load of mind-bending psychedelic drugs and you have to make things that are very weird, and you have to make things that shock people and are very motivated about shocking people out of their reality and bringing these negative energies of shock and twistedness and freakishness. This is the type of energy people are projecting into the culture. And there is maybe one outlet in Western culture that permits an energy in the opposite direction, and this is hip-hop. This is rap music. Because in rap music, you're allowed to be confident and masculine. You're allowed to assert yourself. You're allowed to go out and be a gangbanger. You're allowed to go out and kill people. You're allowed to go out and deal drugs. You're allowed to go out and do things that allow you to assert yourself upon the world. You're allowed to go out and be a bad, bold, masculine man who's full of will to power, who wants to go and get money and get success and get the girls. And you're allowed to go up and rap about this and say, I'm getting money, I'm getting success, I'm getting the girls, I'm the best, I'm better than you. This is the only real place left that you're allowed to express that type of energy. Rock music, you used to be able to do that in the 1980s. There was that sort of high-minded vitality. You were allowed to go out and represent winning energy, if you want to put it this way. But that has definitely fallen off since then. Rock music now is just a sort of group of depressed people singing in the shadow of Kurt Cobain, singing how jaded they are with the world. And so in this Twilight of the Idols passage, Nietzsche is building the case that the aesthetic standard that we should judge art upon is how much it's representing this vital spirit. And we should be very careful that when art comes along that represents this depressing, tortured spirit that's trying to drag us down into something negative, it's trying to drag us down into a bad vibe. Yoga Bunny Nietzsche strikes again, says, no bad vibes inside of here. When that energy shows up, we should be extremely wary of this. We should always think to ourselves, this music that is coming to us, from what place inside the person's soul is this coming from? What is the fountain, the well that this is bursting out of? Is it a man who is full of energy, full of testosterone and full of life? Can you imagine the person making this music gnashing their teeth like a lion in peak summer and wanting to launch themselves at the world and fight and fuck the world into submission? Do they have that vital inner spirit? And the great, great question for you is, can you feel this energy when you participate in a piece of culture? When you go and you look at a statue, or you look at some paintings, or you watch a movie, or you listen to some music? Is culture transmitting into you this vital energy that makes you want to go and fight reality, that makes you want to run up to the wall and headbutt the wall until the wall starts bleeding? Does the culture you listen to impart into you the possibility of peak experiences, of epic feelings, of the rare occasion of winning? Can they impart that energy inside of you? Can it transmit to you the feeling of that enormous potential? Or does it impart inside of you the constant, low, chronic, depressing feeling of being a loser? When you're listening to Kurt Cobain singing about pain, 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 I quite like the music. I think it does have its style, but I understand that it's transmitting this energy. This is a man who is in a constant low-level state of struggle and pain, somebody who's weary with life, a nihilist in his soul getting dragged down into that lower frequency, and that's what was getting transmuted out of it. He was trying to baptize his pain into at least something that's somewhat beautiful. But compare this, for example, to the great statues of ancient Europe, where you see inside of these perfect statues that were lifetimes in the making for many of them, capturing maybe a great general on a horse who was just after winning a battle. And you go and he's on this horse and the horse is rising up, its feet across the ground, the man standing taller than he could ever possibly stand on his horse after defeating an entire army at the peak moment of victory, at the highest experience of his life. Now, when you go and you stand in front of something like this, what are you experiencing? You're experiencing a moment that happened once, maybe once in the entire man's life. Not all those hours of depressing difficulty and pain, but instead one peak experience of incredible ecstasy. And what does this do then? This statue lifts you up and makes you feel this potential, makes you feel that there's a moment, a possibility that you could have where if you win, you justify all the pain. If Kurt Cobain could have one moment of victory, would it justify all the struggle that he was having? There's an interesting question. Now, what you should see here is something quite fascinating. A big problem that we have in the aesthetics and the art world is this inability to be able to judge art. Because people say there is no objective standard of beauty, there's no objective truth, all this type of stuff. Of course, Nietzsche is often accused as being the guy who destroyed objectivity. But what's quite interesting is that Nietzsche, when he is able to brush past all the theory cells, all the philosophy cells, he gets all the dorks out of the way. And you actually listen to him talking about this, you see that he does actually have very clear standards. But he's trying to ground these standards not in some theory cell nonsense, some silly abstractions that don't have any connection to the actual experience of being an artist. Instead, he's trying to ground our ability to judge in the instability of our psychology. He's trying to ground it into our souls and sit down and study our souls and speak to people like artists, because this is what artists understand. Artists understand that they often probably feel like Kurt Cobain, depressed, struggling, life is hard. And maybe the temptation is to sing the blues about that. And that can feel maybe nice. And there's certainly a reality to that that we don't want to deny. But should we also realize that part of the great quest of being a great artist, of being somebody who is ascendant in their vital creations, they're trying to grab onto these enormous peak experiences, these experiences of epic, indomitable winning, these experiences of achieving the great things in life. And what gets born out of this Nietzschean perspective is such a profound notion, almost like a biological purpose to art. Art is supposed to be, in some sense, the carrot on the stick that entrances people to continue to fight true suffering, to aim for these peak moments. So if I create a big gorgeous statue and put it in the middle of the city of the greatest man from the city conquering the rival tribe in his moment of apex victory, that can inspire every single young man in that city for generations, perhaps centuries, to want to reach that apex experience. That can lift an entire city out of suffering, and it almost has this biological role in helping people psychologically conquer the lower emotions. There's like this spiritual purpose to art here. And you can think about this on the primal level. This is maybe the simplest way we can ground this in our psychological reward systems. Think about how this lion we were talking about earlier, this vital man full of energy who's feeling good, feeling powerful, who's crusading around the savannah, crusading around life and winning. He's not like Kurt Cobain. He's the Chad, the alleged Chad of Reddit. You know, he's walking around winning. And he experiences ecstasy and pleasure a lot in his life. And what this ecstasy and pleasure is coming from is that it's actually a reward that is given to the lion, given to the Chad, for expressing himself, for doing the things that life wants him to do. It's the small moment of reward and peak experience to pat him on the head and say, well done for achieving what you need to achieve. Now think about this in a visceral way, because you have to think about it this way. When you go out and you fight and struggle to become looks max, to become juicy, to become powerful, to become handsome, to become absolutely stacked, you know, have your trifecta put together of status, health, looks, all those types of things, wealth, whatever you want to call it, and you get a girl. You in lion mode pull a female. You are rewarded with a shuddering orgasm if you were capable of defeating all the other people, the pushing away all the competition and having the girl to yourself. You get to shudder and experience that explosion of endorphins and pleasure in order for you to be in that moment right then and there. When you beat a rival in battle, you are given this thrill, this explosion of energy in the moment of victory. You are filled with lust when you finally break your opponent's will and then destroy their body as they lose the ability to resist you. When you do this thing that life considers good, which is you fight your rivals, you hurt them, defeat them, put them down and stand on top of them and say, I have beaten you. I now get to wipe you. Your DNA is pushed out of existence permanently. Your DNA is now squashed and crushed. You are now the slave or you are now the corpse, one of those two things. And my DNA gets to go back to the village and get the girl, and I get to spread my genes. That is life realizing that this version of life is going to win at the expense of that version of life. Now, what does life do? It's so funny. Our casual morality says, oh, well, life should feel very bad for the poor guy who got hurt in the competition. Life is not like that at all. Life is brutal and savage, and she allows this guy who got beaten, the loser, to get crushed, to feel pain, to feel depression. He turns into Kurt Cobain. He's writing his depressed blues songs. He is wasting away and fading out of life. Whereas the strong conqueror, the guy who is just after winning, the guy who is after going through the struggle, is filled with positive emotions. And this is not speculation. After you defeat somebody in competition, you get an enormous dose of testosterone. After you go back to the village and you have sex with the woman, you get an enormous dose of testosterone. You get an enormous dose of oxytocin. Get all the feelings of dopamine, pleasure from when you come inside of her. All the good feelings are given to you. Then you get to go back and you get to feast, you get to eat, and then you get to feel all the pleasure of having food. Pleasure is a reward for you winning. And so what we can conceptualize here is that all these thrills and joys that you are gifted for winning are an example of an enormous explosion of life celebrating within you. Life is in triumph, in joy. I have found the guy who is going to continue and defeat death for me. That guy, that Kurt Cobain, who he's crushed out in the battlefield. Fuck that dude. Let him get squished, because he wasn't going to be able to beat death. Death is this ever-present demon that's trying to kill life all the time, and life really wants to put her energy in the person who is able to make it forward. And so when you are somebody who's capable of winning, when you prove this, life is happy to reward you, happy to fill you with all sorts of enormous feelings as a consequence of this, because what you're doing is you're conquering death on the most fundamental level. You're overcoming resistance, you're overcoming danger, you're overcoming risks, and you're feeling this power of ecstasy. You're feeling this core feeling of power, an enormous feeling of power. So I say all this to point out something very, very fascinating, is that unless somebody is feeling that foundational feeling, they can't really do art properly. So Kurt Cobain, that is like the story, the emotion, the sounds that come out of the dude who got crushed by life, that got crushed by a more powerful force. And so his psychological state is the degenerating, falling energy, the loser. Now, if you can create inside of the soul that feeling of victory, that feeling of triumph, it will sound something like Pavarotti, you know? Pavarotti singing, Vincerò, vince. What is he singing when he's singing this? He's singing victory, victory, victory. There's this epic feeling of winning, endless winning. You're like Charlie Sheen or something like this. And that feeling is the foundation for art, that ecstasy, that thrill. Now, it's not just winning. It can be actually anything, is what Nietzsche's pointing out. But it's a very good thing to keep in mind, is that really strong, intoxicating feeling is the beginning of what we need to focus on. So here's Nietzsche's words himself. For art to be possible at all, that is to say, in order that the aesthetic mode of action and of observation may exist, a certain preliminary physiological state is indispensable: ecstasy. This state of ecstasy must first have intensified the susceptibility of the whole machine, otherwise no art is possible. All kinds of ecstasy, however differently produced, have this power to create art, and above all, the state dependent upon sexual excitement, this most venerable and primitive form of ecstasy. The same applies to that ecstasy which is at the outcome of all great desires, all strong passions, the ecstasy of the feast, of the arena, of the act of bravery, of victory, of all extreme action, the ecstasy of cruelty, the ecstasy of destruction, the ecstasy following upon certain meteorological influences, as for instance that of springtime, or upon the use of narcotics, and finally the ecstasy of will, that ecstasy which results from an accumulated and surging willpower. The essential feature of ecstasy is the feeling of increased strength and abundance. Now, as you can see from this, Nietzsche's not saying something like all art should consist of somebody shuddering an orgasm in a porno or something like this. Instead, he's pointing out that strong feelings are what matter, particularly the intoxicating feeling of power and strength and abundance and having everything. The extreme feelings that you get out of even narcotics, he mentions. Like, what happens when you take drugs? You physiologically add in all these extra chemicals. You have this abundance of dopamine. You take MDMA and you have this explosion of oxytocin and dopamine. It's like sort of orgasmic. And so you're in this state of abundance where you have limitless good feelings. And that's actually quite a good model for something artistic, because it's Dionysian. It's beyond the normal. It's lifting us towards an idealized state, towards an extreme state. What about when you conquer somebody, when you defeat somebody, as we said? The extreme feelings that you feel during that moment, the surging explosion of triumph, of relief, and all this, of a UFC fighter knocking somebody out, this enormous explosion of feelings. This is so rare for people to feel, but if you're able to capture this artistically, you're able to feel that victory and that extreme emotion, and you can represent that inside of art, you do a great service to mankind. You're able to lift an enormous amount of people towards something high, towards something futuristic, towards something ideal and far beyond. You're able to reach us beyond the pettiness, the human, all too human existence we have, and shuttle us towards something great. Why was Napoleon so compelling to people in Nietzsche's era? Because he appeared like this type of character. Everybody felt small. They felt these bureaucracies beginning to swarm over the West. They felt that everything was getting subsumed into mediocrity. The French Revolution rises up and it's this sort of mass egalitarian communist movement trying to pull the old European order down. And then boom, out of nowhere, this enormous explosion shows up. This dragon in the sky, this comet flashing across reality, Napoleon. And Napoleon beat everybody. He was the super winner. He won every battle he was fighting. I think Alexander the Great had like 9 to 12 great victories. Napoleon had something like 35. It was absolutely insane. He was just beating everybody left and right, and he was a superman. He was like a giant lion just roaming across the savannah that everybody was terrified of. He was an enormous representation of superpower, of abundance, of strength beyond all comprehensible belief. And of course, all the artists were gravitated to him like he was some type of sun, some type of force. What a fascinating character. What a representation of extreme will, extreme strength, extreme feelings. Feelings that justify the struggle and the pain and the mediocrity. Now, think of this as like artist life coaching, you know? And Nietzsche coming in and talking to all the young artists and telling them what part of their souls should they focus on in order to be the study for creating art. Has an art teacher ever come in and sat down and said, think about that time where you defeated an enemy, where you conquered, where you achieved something great, where you felt that ecstasy, those extreme feelings of abundance and power, of super winning, of life shuttling forward and being in a state of victory. Instead, you're never told this. Instead, you're told to sit down and meditate on these, the heaviest, darkest, most negative feelings that you have. Meditate on those and try to transform them into some type of tragic, moany story that you can give out into the world. Because that's where art comes from. Art comes from the pain. Art comes from the stress, the struggle, the negative feelings, the depressing energy. Art comes from the weirdest part of you. The weirder, the more screwed up, the more negative, the more botched it is, the better, because that's what makes it interesting, actually, is that when it's this weird, depressing, nihilistic energy, that's the correct study for art. That's the energy you want to bring out into the world. You want to shock people out of what is normal and show them these awkward, surreal, strange feelings. And this actually gives you a great insight into the psychological disposition of the modern or the postmodern artist, the modern nihilistic artist. Here we have a group of punk rockers, and some punk rock can be quite fun, but you can see that there's this sort of fetishization of the strange, the weird. You know, get your bright hair, your weird hair colors, cover yourself in tattoos, make yourself look weird and different and strange. You're a shock entity. It's not something where you're trying to cultivate an enormous feeling of victory and power. Instead, you're trying to shock people out of them. You're trying to drag them into maybe a surreal feeling, something like this. Modern art has this energy in it overall. It sacrifices form, and it sacrifices the desire to create something just pristine and beautiful and unique and special and one-off and very, very difficult to achieve, which is what all great experiences of conquest and high ecstasy are like. And instead, it focuses on the sort of sloppy and weird and awkward and negative, and it's trying to pull you into that strange energy to get you to drag you into that headspace. You actually talk to modern artists, and they will, you could ask them, you know, any good one, you would ask them and say, well, why the fuck do you do all that? Why do you do these weird pictures that don't really have much form? They will say to you, well, the purpose of art is not actually the picture anymore. This is what we've learned in postmodernism. The purpose of art is what you can create inside the person's mind. You know, and again, Nietzsche was very ahead of his time on this. The purpose of art is the feeling you can create inside the person's mind. So when I show you this epic feeling of conquest, what do I create inside of your soul? I create this aspirational, inspirational energy. But what these people are doing with this is that they realize that if they put this fucked up, crazy stuff, it will shock you. It will give you this bizarre, like mildly schizophrenic snapping out of your reality and being like, whoa, where am I? What's going on? They're trying to wake you up from the hell of capitalism or something like this, whatever they believe intellectually. And so the project of their art is kind of like intellectual. It's not aesthetic, but it is actually focused on this psychological project. They just get many other first principles wrong. First of all, they don't have this aspiration towards high art, which is their big issue. They're not aiming towards these high, big, strong feelings. Instead, they're aiming towards the weird, the deviant, the depressing. They're trying to suck you into the sickness of nihilism. And so from all this, we get the next point that Nietzsche is making that, again, is such a profound idea. Because what is the goal of the artist, the purpose of the artist? What is the artist doing? In some sense, the artist is a vessel for life. The artist is a very raw representation of how life works, just maybe on a higher plane. It's a spiritual version of life, if you want to think about it this way. If you think about what life does in its crudest sense, people hate thinking like this, but this is what life is like. I go out there as the lion, as the man. I compete against all the other men because life has put me in this arena with all these other pieces of life. And my job is to prove that I'm the version of life that deserves the energy for life, because I'm the best, the strongest one that's capable of defeating death. So we're all in this arena. Death is killing us all. And we have to eat each other to prove that we're the version that is right. It sounds weird, but when you think about it, this is absolutely true. Think about food. What is food? What's going on with food, lads? You eat it every single day. Food, you can't eat rocks. Well, you could try. I've met some people. But most people don't eat rocks. All animals eat other animals, eat other plants. We eat life. So what life does is it consumes the worms. You know, the birds consume the worms, and they're eating that so they can grow and become big. And then the snake eats the bird, and then the snake dies and it grows into the grass. And then the cow comes along and eats that. And it's all these systems, these entities stealing energy off each other, till eventually the lion comes along and eats the ruminant, eats the cow. And the lion is at the top of the food chain, so the lion receives the most calories, so it can actually evolve and transform into the most sophisticated organism in the entire ecosystem. It can experience the most pleasure, it can experience the most joy, experiences the most power, the most safety, and becomes more intelligent and more sophisticated. Predators tend to have bigger brains than prey. They tend to have better empathetic qualities than prey, not empathy in like, I love you, but the ability to understand. They've got bigger mirror neurons and things like this, or more mirror neurons. They tend to be more complicated, more sophisticated. Us animals are bigger than insects. We're more sophisticated in many ways. all because we're higher in the food chain. Look at mankind themselves. How sophisticated are we than our closest rivals, perhaps the chimps, or I don't know what goes on underneath the water. Do the dolphins run a mafia down there or something like this, or the lions? We're beyond belief how much further we are than everybody else, because we're top of the food chain. Our position as the apex of the food chain means that we get to consume all the other animals. What do? We set up these giant factory systems and feed in all these cows so that we can murder them en masse, transform them into burgers and feed all the Americans. We're incredibly profound and powerful, and we get to consume all their calories. Life is built off us consuming life. That's the fundamental way that it works, and their lives get deleted so that we can grow more complicated and more sophisticated, so we can experience mouth pleasure, so we can feel energy. They are the expense for our existence to perpetuate. The goal of life is to reward the strongest and make them grow more sophisticated and more powerful. And life does this by letting them feel pleasure. It feels good to eat high fat, high meat animal meat, because it feels good, because life is trying to reward you, saying this is calories. This poor ruminant, this cow, spent a long time eating grass in order to fill itself with this much calories. Good on you for killing it and eating it. That's good. That's a lot of calories for you. Very calorie dense. Good. If you're able to kill this, you're worth it. You're good enough. It's this brutal law of life that's inbuilt to the way it works. So there's this very, very deep relationship with pleasure, with reward, with the experience of power and abundance, the ecstasy of feasting, of conquering, of killing off the rivals and coming inside the girls. All of this is positive reward from life, saying you're the star of the show, you're the guy, you're the one that matters. And this all becomes clear as day inside sexuality, because what happens when you have sex? You put your semen, you come inside the girl, you come inside this woman, and she becomes a host of a baby that looks like you and her, and you propagate this way. You get to replicate yourself. All the calories that you feed her then thereafter go into making your kid. A little version of yourself is born that looks like you, that acts like you, that thinks like you, that is created in the image of you. You create one of them. You create another version of yourself, because life is trying to reward you. And you can go and you can come inside that girl many times and create like 10 kids if you so want, and create a little army of boyos that all look like you. And you propagate, you create more of yourself. You get permission from life to continue to create more versions of yourself, because you've proven that you're good enough, because you've killed the enemies, you've killed the animals, you've cleared up space, you killed all the rivals, took the girl, killed all the cows, got the food, and now you can propagate. If you're able to do that, if you're able to win, if you're able to go through those experiences of triumph and create this space and create this place for yourself and this girl, you deserve to make more versions of yourself. You're obviously a good tool in this war against death that life is waging. And so what we're seeing is there's a brutal creative process happening in life. The weak get destroyed, they get turned into Kurt Cobains and put in the trash bin. They can no longer propagate themselves. Their feelings and reality, their DNA gets wiped out of existence. It is not good enough. Life throws it in the bin. It does not care. And you, the one that worked, gets rewarded with procreating. You get rewarded with pleasure. You get to come loads of times. You get to have all these joyful experiences of watching these little kids that look like you get all happy. You get to murder animals and give their bodies to your children so your children grow strong and get to do it all over again. And there's this creative process where life is selecting. This is what we all heard about, you know? Life is choosing to reward this vessel, this entity, this organism. This is the one that gets to win. This is the one that gets to continue with the existence. And this is a process of evolution. This is a process of idealization. This is a process of something becoming better, something becoming chosen. Because what is an ideal? What is something that we celebrate? What is something that we value? We value things that we consider excellent and high and important. And life is doing this through the selection process. Life is discriminating against things and choosing other things and leading us in this direction. And all of this hinges on you, because you're the main character. You're the guy who's invested in this project. You're a piece of life. And it's on you to kill all the other guys, claim all the calories for yourself, and assert yourself forward to get the girl, to procreate. That's the project of life for you. And your goal is to try force everything to participate in your soul, in your will, in your joys. You're forcing reality to give you pleasure, to feel this ecstasy. That's what your job is to do. When you beat other people, you're doing it so you can feel good. There's this inherent selfishness. And of course, that has to be there. People struggle with this an awful lot. Oh, it's not very moral to think this way. But the lion has to believe in itself, or else it would never be able to fight to the death. It would never be able to fight for its position. It has to want to win. It has to say that I deserve to procreate, to create more versions of myself. I am the apex vessel of life, and I will go out there and I will prove it. And so any person with this strong vital soul, anybody who feels like a man, who feels like he should be here, he should be the one procreating, injecting himself into reality, creating more versions of himself, the guy who's willing to push away everybody else and throw their DNA and his rivals in the trash bin. In order for this guy to be like this, he has to be aware. He has to feel that he's transforming the world into his image. He's asserting himself upon the world. This is what is happening. When you orgasm inside of a woman, you are transforming her forever, forever. It's permanent. This is why it's such a big event. This is why it feels so good. This is why it's so emotionally intense. Because you come inside of her and your sperm impregnates her. Her DNA is changed forever. Look up microchimerism. There's a red pill for you. Forever it changes. You're giving her a destiny. Her parents spent her whole life killing cows in order to grow her and make her big and strong. And now you get to go and come inside of her and change her forever. To the entire labor of her parents and all of her ancestors come up to this moment for you, sloppy dork, to go and do what you're going to do and give her this destiny. It's an enormous moment. And that's how big of a deal it is. And you're doing this to create a version of yourself, to imprint yourself into her, to imprint your soul into her body forever, to create another version of yourself. That's how big of a deal it is, to give her a destiny for that long. When you defeat an opponent or kill an animal, you are enacting enormous amounts of violence upon them and forcing them to be consumed by your will, to be a part of your life force, a part of your life project. You, as the creator, you are destroying them and consuming their bodies, consuming everything about them, annihilating them like a monster. You know, a big gaping wide open mouth. You're eating them alive. Either, you know, if there's a rival, maybe not, but you know what I'm saying. And they're losing their vision, their dream, in order for you to continue forward with your one. In the UFC, when two people are fighting, one guy is going to lose and one guy is going to win. And what is happening there? One guy has this dream of being world champion. The other guy has this dream of being world champion. And one of these people is going to have their face, their jaw broken. And they're going to be put down and they're going to collapse and they're going to lose. And their destiny is going to be a sacrifice towards the other guy's victory and the other guy's dream getting fulfilled. There's always these consequences. The prey animal no longer can propagate its DNA. It can no longer create more versions of itself. You end that project. The opponent the same. You end that project for him. It's so serious. They become sacrifices to your destiny. This is how big of a deal it is. And so in the primal sense, you are destroying the world, destroying everything around you and sucking it all up into you so you can express it as your vision, your will and your destiny to make yourself more powerful and more sophisticated. This is the primal psychology, the primal logic that is underneath all of this stuff. This is the how life creates. Now, why would the project of art be any different? Art can only be a spiritual version of this. And so what a vital artist is doing is he's getting in touch with these feelings inside of his soul. He feels these enormous emotions of power, of triumph, of overcoming. And he looks at the world around him. Now, he's not going to try to run around like Primal Man and come inside everything and try to transform it this way, because he's operating in a higher plane. He's not able to do this. He's not able to go and grab marble or a building and, you know, stick his willy inside of it and try to impregnate it. He can't do that. Instead, he has to inseminate it with something else. He has to try transform it into his image in a different way. He has to launch his soul upon it in a different way, just like how the Primal Man launches his passions upon the woman and transforms the woman by putting himself inside of her and forcing himself via passion and energy into her, which permanently changes her in this sort of messy, squelchy, extreme scene of orgasm and juice and all this. Instead, the vital artist with this primal energy feels these enormous emotions and wants to launch himself upon the world and wants to transform the world. But he's dealing with the raw material of the world. He's looking at stones. He's looking at like colors. He's looking at these very much more sophisticated things in the world. He's looking at the soundscape. He's looking at language. He's looking at these things. And what he's doing is he's attacking, he's grabbing onto these things and he's beating them into shape until they represent him, until they are a reflection of something inside of him, until they reflect and capture these perfect moments and these highest feelings. The vital artist is seizing everything around him and forcing it into shapes that reflect his soul. The vital artist grabs a stone and stabs it with a chisel until a statue appears that is reflecting his face and the image of him, his very self at his highest moment, or perhaps maybe somebody in his city who he considers a great man. The vital artist is beating the stone into shape so it's a reflection of the most enormous ideals and dreams and visions inside of his head. The vital artist forces himself into the realm of sound and fills it with his tones and his tempos, his language, his words, so that it reflects the energy he felt when he was defeating or overcoming or conquering, or the people that he admires, the people that are a part of his tribe that he sees as valuable and as representations of these things, these great epic feelings. This is what these artists do. They gravitate towards these enormous emotions, these enormous feelings, and then they seize upon the cosmos and force it to participate in their joy and their abundance and their ecstasy. He grabs color and he arranges it in such a way on a painting so that it is an expression of this ecstasy. It's exploding out of him. And the way you can think about this is, look at Michelangelo. Look at Michelangelo when he was creating the statue of David. He was forcing the marble to reveal to him the image of David, standing in noble scorn. He was this image of David was reflecting back something into Michelangelo, perhaps one of the grand feelings he felt inside of his life. Michelangelo had to, at some level, feel something that epic, had to have an emotion inside of himself that was that high, that profound, to be able to capture it in the stone in such a perfect way. And Michelangelo was even described it this way. Michelangelo said that he could see an angel trapped in the stone, and he was filled with this frenzy inside of himself, this enormous emotion built up inside of him, and he was trying to release this angel. He was trying to attack the stone and chip it away so that he could reveal David. David was alive inside of the stone, and he was asserting himself upon the stone and beating it into shape and giving the marble a destiny. He was transforming the world. He's like a Minecraft character building some like elaborate thing. He's beating the world into shape and making it in the image of his deepest, deepest soul, the spiritual version of a sort of sexual transformation of the world. And so this brings us to the conclusion and the idea of why this sexual project of art is so profound, because it's lifting this psychological reality. It's lifting it up into a more, maybe we could say, spiritual realm or something like this. And what we see is these enormous feelings of ecstasy, these enormous feelings of victory and conquest and profoundness. And people like Michelangelo, they feel these big feelings inside of themselves, and they make it this project that they have to create this and manifest this, and they have to beat a big lump of marble into shape, or they have to, you know, take the soundscape and force into sound, into reality, some type of tones and structure that captures this enormous feeling. And that's the right art to make. That's the art that lifts up the spirit of everybody. Now, why does it lift up the spirit of everybody in such a successful way? Because, as we said, the thing that motivates you to go after the girl is the orgasm. It's the carrot on the end of the stick. It's the reward that you get. It's how life tricks you into participating in life. Life gives you this big shuddering orgasm when you're with that girl, and it makes you go through all that stress of going to the gym and getting in shape and doing all these things so that you do that. It's life's way of bringing you along for it. And so you go through this enormous amount of stress just for that one moment where you come very hard, and then it's over. And it doesn't last long. It's only brief, but in many senses, like, as you're doing it, you're kind of being like, yeah, it was worth it. You're sort of saying, yeah, it was pretty good, man. And in that moment, you're eternal. Pleasure has this sort of eternity, this justification, this way of beating all pain and all suffering and all struggle. It has this way of overcoming life itself, overcoming the stress, this enormous experience of orgasm and pleasure, these peak experiences of victory. Nietzsche called this the amor fati, the love of your destiny can happen when you have a couple of moments that are good enough, that are high enough to justify all of the struggle that you went through. Nietzsche writing Zarathustra was an artistic orgasm that justified the fact that he went insane, the fact that he had all this struggle in his life, the fact that he had these stomach issues, he almost went blind. All that stress that he went through is okay, it's good, it's fine. It's in some sense, it's actually perfect. It's justified in the fact that the art that he created was high enough, that was good enough. The art is eternal, and so therefore all that he went through makes sense and is good. And he would look back on that from the position of eternity and be like, I would go and live that life again if I got to write Zarathustra again and create something that is full of these enormous feelings. So there's something here where these peak experiences that real vital artists are reaching for has this salvation that it brings us in our lives. And there's this one problem that we have with these peak experiences is that they do not last. They are orgasms. Perfect moments of pleasure do not last. Victory happens and then it's gone. You have your triumph after your victory and then it's over. The UFC fighter knocks a guy out, you're a champion for one day and then you're back to normal the next day. The peak experience fades away. And it's very possible for us to forget these peak experiences. We can go, we can experience orgasm, we can experience victory, we can experience hunger and joy, and then it floats away in time. And then we're back into the depressing reality of stress and struggle where we're trying to build up towards another peak. And that's very hard on us. And sometimes maybe we can forget about these peak experiences. We can get caught in a negative spiral where we can't see this stuff anymore. But when an artist can capture one of these feelings and install it into reality in this spiritual way, he overcomes time. He overcomes this factor of pleasure where an orgasm, a victory is temporary. It fades very quickly. A statue doesn't. A song is there forever. A great piece of literature is there forever. Zarathustra is there forever. It can be enjoyed forever. And this is profound. This is what an innovation by mankind when you think about it. That these great artists can dig inside of themselves, almost like get rid of all the negative, the negativity, the depressing, bad feelings that they have in themselves, overcome all that stuff and just capture in like a book or a song or a statue, this enormous, massive, the highest, best feelings of their, like all the orgasms of their life put together in one feeling and then download that, assert that giant feeling into a piece of stone and beat the stone into shape until that piece of stone stands there. And then all of a sudden it exists. It's this vibrant, charged piece of energy. And then all of us can go and look at this statue and we can feel that pleasure. We can feel that excellent feeling inside of it. We can have a sort of like spiritual sexual experience. We can, you know, it blows our minds. And this is, again, this is not kind of wacky or far out. This is what happens when you listen to music. You get hits of dopamine and endorphins. You get orgasmic experiences from music. I've listened to music and you get the shudders. You get the thrills. That happens. You go in the presence of Michelangelo's David and you like are in the presence of an angel. You're in the presence of a god. You're in the presence of something that lives forever, that is higher than everything else. You stand around that and you realize what man is. Like, it's so fascinating, but you can go out into the streets and you look at all maybe the people who are struggling and the people who are having trouble with their lives and they can overcome themselves. And you become very wary with man. You say, we're surrounded by last men. Last men are so terrible. Last men everywhere. You might even look at yourself and see many of these traits inside of yourself. You're a dope dopamine addict, you're addicted to all these terrible things. And you can have this very negative image of yourself and of mankind as a consequence of this. You can turn into a bit of a Kurt Cobain. But then you go to Renaissance Italy, you know, and you walk around and look at this thing that was created 500 years ago, like the statue of David. David, it stands 12 foot tall. You're looking up at it like it's a god. You're looking up at it as something that is better than you. It's an angel. It is in some sense a sort of glimpse of the next level, the Ubermensch. It's a permanent orgasm put into place and you can feel that energy off it. You realize that there's things that are bigger than you and they're real. It doesn't require you to believe or any, like, it's real, it's there. You can be in the presence of these things. And there's an enormous amount of psychological energy charged inside of these. And this is what a vital artist does. They create these artifacts that we can actually grab hold of, and they lift our spirits. They remind us what we are. They connect us with this eternal realm of pleasure. These moments of incredible victory are cast into stone and made permanent forever. This painting of Napoleon, you know, the famous painting of Napoleon as he crossed the Alps, that gives us this permanent vision of a victorious great man. The paintings of Julius Caesar and stuff like this, the writings of Nietzsche, all these enormous creative projects justify man's struggle because they install inside of it the ecstasy, the orgasm, the peak experiences of mankind into an eternal form that we can all feast off forever. And they're showing us the best version of ourselves, the ideals that we can have going forward. Just like when, you know, the primal man is fighting, and he's the valuable ideal version that gets to come inside the woman and produce more children. It's almost like the artist does the very same thing. He fights against life itself, and then he produces in his artworks these sort of eternal gems that show us the next level that we can all aspire to go towards. And this is giving us a direction, and it's giving us a purpose, and giving us a vision of what it is like to overcome ourselves. And of course, that is the purpose of life, as Nietzsche would say, is to constantly overcome ourselves and continue to go up the next level. And to put it all in one simple notion, in vital art, we get a glimpse of perfection, of eternity, of the highest, most pleasurable experience. We get to see the realm of the gods. We get to be in heaven for a brief moment. As Nietzsche says, everything around the vital artist is a tool for such a man to rejoice over himself, to rejoice about what is high in himself, and to conquer what is low in himself. Through art, man rejoices over himself as perfection. What a beautiful idea. Imagine Michelangelo kneeling in this sort of vivid ecstasy at the foot of David. He's been in this frenzy for months, trying to create this form. This feeling has been inside of him that he's trying to release something, create something. He had to create this sort of eternal entity. He was releasing this angel. And finally, at the end of it, he shears away all the stone and he's looking up at it. And he's filled with this feeling of enormous ecstasy. The first time that anybody has ever looked at the statue of David. And he realizes his whole life is justified at this point, because he is fallen, he's destined to die, he's human, all too human, he's going to get pulled back into samsara and the world of suffering, he's going to get pulled back into all that stuff, and it's going to be terrible. But all of that is okay, because he has given birth to an angel. He has given birth to something that is higher. He has overcome himself, he has overcome life, he has overcome the temporal world. He has created something perfect. And in that, he rejoices. Again, these feelings of ecstasy are these feelings of abundance. What is more abundant than eternal pleasure for all of time? You create David, and you have this piece of stone that generates eternal pleasure in people for all of time. For as long as that exists, we will all be able to feast off it in this sort of orgasmic spiritual state, continuing to inspire us and motivate us to go on. That's a great artist. That's something. The service that somebody like that does for mankind is unmatched when you think about it. They overcome all their stress, all their struggle to create something like that. And you think about our culture now, the selfishness, the self-indulgence, the weakness, the lack of will, the shoddiness and stupidity for us to get wrought up in all our negative emotions, our depressing feelings that allow ourselves to pull down, and for us to be as crude and silly to transform all of this most depressing emotions into art, into these, we put that out into the world as infections instead of lifting people up and lifting us towards what is ascendant and high, these grand feelings. We create a cult of Kurt Cobain losers. And of course, what does this do to us? Well, it demoralizes us. It creates this spiritual malaise and disease that destroys us, that eats away at our minds, that makes us weaker and weaker, that makes us give up on life, that transforms us into nihilists. And Western culture has been going on this very, very negative trend for the last while. And I tell you that there's a lot of people now who are waking up to this. There's a lot of people realizing that that has a negative energy. A lot of us are very good yoga bunnies, and we feel the force is telling us that there's something up with this. And there's a lot of people that are moving towards these ideas that I'm talking about here. And I think this is it. I think the conception here is the big notion. I think Nietzsche was correct. I think Nietzsche nailed it 100%. He understood. He conceptualized it well. And there's going to come a vanguard of new creators in the next while that are going to be full of this energy, that are going to get this, that understand that they're reaching towards what is ascendant, what is high, what is grand, what is powerful. And they are going to pull it off. They're going to start generating culture that is going in this opposite direction. The era of the vital artists is upon us. So I hope you enjoyed that tyrannical rant against Kurt Cobain. I don't think he's that bad, to be perfectly honest. He's all right. We're not gonna be resentful. That wouldn't be very Nietzschean, would it? Now to sign off, I want to talk to you about some victories I had in my own life. Last summer, a gentleman came into my online program, and his name was Antiprophet. And I think it's a great symbol of the fact that we do good stuff over here in the Uber Boyle program, because that gentleman just hit 1 million views on YouTube. Now, he came in last summer and he had no social media. He was looking for help planning out what to do with his brand. Look at him now. I guess we must be doing something right. And on top of this, around about the same time, I started to get into artificial intelligence art. This was on the prompting of some of the artists within my network, and we began to experiment with this. And what has happened since then is that we have gotten hired for one of the biggest influencers in the world to help them do a series. Now, this has been an enormous success as well. And the reason why we did so well with that project is very similar to why I'd say the Antiprophet has been so successful. I have a very big focus on first principle thinking. I realized a long time ago, with all these new technologies coming out like social media and now artificial intelligence, that the key for you being able to stand out, to cut through the noise, is your capacity to use classical skills like storytelling, to be the best speaker, to be the best writer, to be the person who can think about the best ideas, to be able to structure and create a story that is best presented to the world. And because of this, whenever new technologies show up, like social media, it allows me to tell these stories better at scale. And when people come and learn these ideas off me, they tend to do very well. And of course, when something like artificial intelligence shows up, a new technology, all the same principles work. A lot of people tinker with artificial intelligence, but I have the ability to use it well to tell strong narratives. I understand what I'm doing, so we adapt to it faster. My team are better than everybody else in the world. We experience that ecstasy of victory because we have these good first principles put into place. So if you would like to learn these first principles, I have them all laid out in clear step-by-step processes in my program. There is a group of like-minded boyos who all follow this channel that you can come in and communicate and chat with and talk to about these things. I will be in there as well. And you can go down below to the link in the description and you can sign up right then and there and begin the process today. And then you can use these first principles, this step-by-step process, this plan to crush all the Kurt Cobains of the world, to feel the ecstasy of power shuttling through your veins, to use AI to create, I don't know, Statue of David Part 2. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but maybe it will. We'll see what happens. I guess we'll only know if we try. So thank you for your time. Check it out down there below, and I will see you on the other side.